Fraud of Feminism by E. Belfort Bax, Part 9. Being Female, a title to special privileges. In treating this question, insofar as it bears on the criminal law, it is important to distinguish carefully between the softening of the whole system of punishment due to the general development of humanitarian tendencies and the special discrimination made in favour of the female sex. These two things are very often inadequately distinguished from one another. Punishment may have become more humane where men are concerned. It may have advanced up to a certain point in this direction, but its character is not essentially changed. As regards women, however, the whole conception of criminal punishment and penal discipline has altered. Sex privilege has now been definitely established as a principle. Now, a complete investigation of the psychology of this curious phenomenon we have been considering, namely, the hatred so common with men for their fellow men as a sex, is a task which has never yet been properly taken in hand. Its obverse side is to be seen on all hands in the conferring and confirming of sex prerogative on women. Not very long ago, as we have seen, one of its most striking manifestations came strongly under public notice, namely the rule of the sea, by which women, by virtue of their sex, can claim to be saved from a sinking ship before men. The fact that the laws and practices in which this man-hatred and woman-preference find expression are contrary to every elementary sense of justice, in many cases, conflict with public policy, and can obviously be seen to be purely arbitrary, matters not. The majority of men feel no sense of the injustice, although they may admit the fact of the injustice when categorically questioned. They are prepared, when it comes to the point, to let public policy go by the board, rather than entrench upon the sacred privilege and immunity of the female. While as to the arbitrary and unreasoning nature of the aforesaid laws and practices, not being troubled with a logical conscience, this does not affect them. I must confess to being unequal to the task of accurately fathoming the psychological condition of the average man who hates man in general and loves woman in general, to the extent of going contrary to so many apparently basal tendencies of human nature as we know it otherwise. The reply, of course, will be an appeal to the power of the sexual instinct, but this, I must again repeat, will not explain the rise, or, if not the rise, at least the marked expansion of the sentiment in question during the last three generations or thereabouts. Even apart from this, while I am well aware of the power of sexual love to affect anything in the mind of man as regards its individual object, I submit it is difficult to conceive how it can influence so strongly men's attitude towards women who they have not seen, or even where they have seen them, when there is no question of sexual attraction, or again as regards the collectivity of women, the abstract category, woman in general. We have already dealt with the anti-man campaign in the press, especially in modern novels and plays. This, as we have remarked, often takes the form of direct abuse of husbands and lovers, and the attempt to make them look ridiculous as a foil to the brilliant qualities of wives and sweethearts. But we sometimes find the mere laudation of woman herself, apart from any direct anti-manism, assume the character of an intellectual emetic. A much-admired contemporary novelist, depicting a wedding ceremony in fashionable society circles, describes the feelings of his hero, a young man disgusted with the hollowness and vanity of society and all its ways, as follows. Quote, The bride was opposite him now, and by an instinct of common chivalry, he turned away his eyes. It seemed to him a shame to look at that downcast head above the silver mystery of her perfect raiment, the modest head full, doubtless, of devotion and pure yearnings, the stately head, where no such thought as, "How am I looking this day of all days before all London?" had ever entered. The proud head, where no such fear as, "How am I carrying it off?" could surely be besmirching. He saw below the surface of this drama, played before his eyes, and set his face, as a man might who found himself assisting at a sacrifice. Close quote. Now, I ask you, can it be believed that the writer of the above flamboyant feminist fustian is a novelist and playwright of established reputation who undoubtedly has done good work? The obvious criticism must surely strike every reader that it is somewhat strange that this divinely innocent creature he glorifies should arise straight out of a milieu which is shown up as the embodiment of hollowness and conventional superficiality. If men can lay the butter on thick in their laudation of womanhood, female idolaters of their own sex can fairly outbid them. At the time of writing, there has just come under my notice a dithyram in the journal The Clarion by Miss Winifred Blatchford on the sacrosanct perfections of womanhood in general, especially as exemplified in the suicidal exploits of the late lamented Emily Wilding Davidson of Epsom fame, and a diatribe on the purity, beauty, and unapproachable glory of woman. According to this lady, the glory of womanhood seems to extend to every part of the female organism, but, we are told, is especially manifested in the hair, oozing into the roots, apparently. Evidently, there is something especially sacred in woman's hair. This prose ode to woman, as exemplified in Emily Davidson, culminates in the invocation, "Will the day ever come when a woman's life will be rated higher than that of a jockey?" Poor jockey. We will trust not, though present appearances do indicate a strong tendency to regard a woman as possessing the prerogatives of the sacred cow of Indian or ancient Egyptian fame. It is impossible to read or hear any discussion on, say, the marriage laws, without it being apparent that the female side of the question is the one element of the problem which is considered worthy of attention. The undoubted iniquity of our existing marriage laws is always spoken of as an injustice to the woman, and the changes in the direction of greater freedom, which are advocated as a relief to the wife, bound to a bad or otherwise unendurable husband. That the converse case may happen, that the reviled and despised thing, a husband, may also have reason to desire relief from a wife whose angelic qualities and vast superiority to his own vile male self he fails to appreciate, never seems to enter into the calculation at all. That no satisfactory formulation of the psychology of the movement of feminism has yet been offered is undoubtedly true. For the moment, I take it. All we can do is coordinate the facts as a case of what we may term social hypnotism, of those waves of feeling uninfluenced by reason, which are a phenomenon so common in history, witchcraft, manias, flagellant fanaticisms, religious revivals, and similar social upheavals. The belief that woman is oppressed by man, and that the need for remedying that oppression at all costs is urgent, partly at least, doubtless belongs to this order of phenomena. That this feeling is widespread and held in various degrees of intensity by large numbers of persons, men no less than women, is not to be denied. That it is of the nature of a hypnotic wave of sentiment, uninfluenced by reason, is shown by the fact that argument does not seem to touch upon it. You may show conclusively that facts are opposed to the assumption that so far from women being oppressed, the very contrary is the case, that the existing law and its administration is in no essential respect whatsoever unfavourable to women, but, on the contrary, is, as a whole, grossly unfair to men, it is all to no purpose. Your remonstrances, in the main, fall on deaf ears, or, shall we say, they fall off the mind coated with feminist sentiment, as water falls from the proverbial duck's back. The facts are ignored, and the sentiment prevails. The same old catchwords, the same lies and threadbare fallacies are repeated. The fact that they have been shown to be false counts for nothing. The hypnotic wave of sentiment sweeps reason aside and compels men to believe that woman is oppressed and man the oppressor, and believe it they will. If facts are against the idée fixe of the hypnotic suggestion, so much the worse for the facts. Thus far, the feminist dogma of the oppression of the female sex. As regards the obverse side of this sentimental feminism, which issues in ferocious sex laws directed against men for offences against women, laws enacting barbarous tortures such as the cat, and which are ordered with gusto in all their severity in our criminal courts, this probably is largely traceable to the influence of sadic lusts, an agitation such as that which led to the passing of the White Slave Traffic Act, so-called, of 1912, is started, an agitation engineered largely by the inverted libidinousness of social purity mongers, and on the crest of this agitation, the votaries of sadistic cruelty have their innings. The foolish, sentimental feminist at large, whose indignation against a wicked man is fanned to fury by bogus tales, and his judgment captured by representations of the severities requisite to stamp out the evil he is assured is so widespread, lends his fatuous support to the measures proposed. The judicial bench is, of course, delighted at the increase of power given it over the prisoner in the dock, and should any of their puisnes happen to have sadistic proclivities, they are as happy as horses in clover, and the cat flourishes like a green bay tree.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Let us now turn to the question of the psychology of political feminism. Political feminism, as regards its immediate demand of female suffrage, is based directly on the modern conception of democracy. This is its avowed basis. With modern notions of universal suffrage, it is declared that the exclusion of women from the franchise is logically incompatible. If you include in the parliamentary voting lists all sorts and conditions of men, it is said, it is plainly a violation of the principle of democracy to exclude more than one half of the adult population from the polls. As Mill used to say in his advocacy of female suffrage, so long as the franchise was restricted to a very small section of the population, there may have been nothing noteworthy in the exclusion of women. But now that the mass of men are entitled to the vote, and the avowed aim of democracy is to extend it to all men, the refusal to extend it still further to women is an anomaly and a manifest inconsistency. But in this, Mill and others who have used his argument omitted to consider one very vital point. The extensions of the suffrage, such as have been demanded and in part obtained by democracy up to the present agitation, have always referred to the removal of class barriers, wealth barriers, race barriers, etc. In a word, social barriers. That never to the removal of barriers based on deep-lying organic difference, i.e. barriers determining not sociological but biological distinctions. The case of sex is unique in this connection, and this fact vitiates any analogy between the extension of suffrage to women and its extension to fresh social strata, such as democracy has hitherto had in view, terminating in the manhood suffrage which is the ultimate goal of all political democrats. Now, sex constitutes an organic or biological difference, just as a species constitutes another, and of course a stronger, biological difference. Hence, I contend the mere fact of this difference rules out the bare appeal to the principle of democracy per se, as an argument in favour of the extension of the suffrage to women. There is, I submit, no parity between the principle and practice of democracy as hitherto understood, and the new extension proposed to be given to the franchise by the inclusion of women within its pale. And yet there is no question but that the apparent but delusive demand of logical consistency in this question has influenced and still influences many an honest Democrat in his attitude in this matter. But although the recognition of the difference of sex as being an organic difference, and therefore radically other than social difference of caste, class, wealth, or even race, and by this he means nation, undoubtedly invalidates the appeal to the Democrat on the ground of consistency, to accept the principle of female suffrage, yet it does not necessarily dispose of the question. It merely leaves the ground free for the problem as to whether the organic distinction implied in sex does or does not involve corresponding intellectual and moral differences in the female sex, which it is proposed to enfranchise, and furthermore, whether such differences, if they exist, involve general inferiority, or at least an unfitness ad hoc for the exercise of political functions. These questions we have, I think, sufficiently discussed already in the present work. The fact of the existence of exceptionally able women in various departments does undoubtedly mislead many men in their judgment as to the capacity of the average woman to think politically, or otherwise to show herself the effective equal of the average man, morally and intellectually. The reasons for answering this question in the negative we have already briefly indicated in the course of our investigations. This renders it unnecessary to discuss the matter any further here. In dealing with the psychological aspects of the feminist movement, the intellectual conditions which paved the way for its acceptance, it is worthwhile recalling two or three typical instances of the class of argument to be heard on occasion from the female advocates for the suffrage. Thus, when the census was taken in 1911 and the Women's Political and Social Union conceived, as they thought, the brilliant idea of annoying the authorities and vitiating the results of the census by refusing to allow themselves to be enrolled, one of the leaders, when interviewed on the point, gave her reason for her refusal to be included in the following terms: "I am not a citizen," meaning that she did not possess the franchise, "and I am not going to pretend to be one." The silliness of this observation is, of course, obvious, seeing that the franchise or even citizenship has nothing whatsoever to do with the census, which includes infants, besides criminals, lunatics, and imbeciles. Again, in a manifesto of the Women's Political and Social Union, defending window smashing and other militant outrages, it was pointed out that the coal strike had caused more injury than the window smashing, and yet the strikers were not prosecuted, as the window smashers were. In other words, the exercise of the basal personal right of the free man to withhold his labour, save under the conditions agreed to by him, is paralleled with criminal outrage against person and property. Again, some 3 or 4 years ago, when the Women's Suffrage Bill had passed the Commons, on its being announced by the government that for the remainder of the session no further facilities could be given for private members' bills, save for those of a non-contentious character, one of these sapient females urged in the press that, seeing that there were persons to be found in both the orthodox political camps who were in favour of female suffrage, therefore the bill in question must be regarded as of a non-contentious character. Once more, a lady writing a few months ago to one of the weekly journals remarked that through deliberate window breaking, destruction of letters and arson, though they might be illegal acts, yet that the punishing of them by imprisonment with hard labour, they being political offences, was also an illegal act, with the conclusion that the militants and the authorities both alike have committed illegal acts and were both quits. These choice specimens of suffragettes' logic are given as throwing a significant light on the mental condition of women in the suffragette movement, and indirectly on female psychology in general. One would presumably suppose that the women who put them forward must have failed to see the exhibition that they were making of themselves, that any human being out of an asylum could have sunk to the depth of fatuous, inconsequent idiocy they indicate would seem scarcely credible. Is the order of imbecility which the above and many similar utterances reflect confined to suffragette intelligence alone, or does it point to radical inferiority of intellectual fibre, not in degree merely, but in kind, in the mental constitution of the human female generally? Certainly, it is hard to think that any man, however low his intelligence, would be capable of making a fool of himself precisely in the way that these women are continually doing in their attempts to defend their cause and their tactics. In the foregoing podcasts, we have endeavoured to trace some of the leading strands of thought that make up the modern feminist movement. Sentimental feminism clearly has its roots in sexual feeling and in the tradition of chivalry, albeit the notion of chivalry has essentially changed in the course of its evolution. For the rest, sentimental feminism, with its double character of man antipathy and woman sympathy, as we see it today, has assumed the character of one of those psychopathic social phenomena which have so often recurred in history. It can only be explained, like the latter, as a hypnotic wave passing over society. As for political feminism, we have shown that this largely has its roots in a fallacious application of the notion of democracy, partaking largely of the logical fallacy known technically as a dicto secundum quid ad dictum simpliciter. This logical fallacy of political feminism is, of course, reinforced and urged forward by sentimental feminism. As coming under the head of the psychology of the movement, we have also called attention to some curious phenomena of logical imbecility, noticeable in the utterances of educated women in the suffragette agitation.